Okay, let's go ahead and get started. If others come, we'll just include them as they come. My name is Chuck Cluth, and I graduated from Augustana in Rock Island, Illinois.
Yeah.
And back in the late Pleistocene, we'll get to that. And then did graduate work at Northern Arizona University and University of Arizona. And so it's my pleasure to come and talk about geology this week. And I think this the write-up for this session was a little drier than I hoped the session would be. It sounded more like a lecture, but it isn't. Actually, these sessions in geology... That didn't take... What did I say?
No. Yeah, 2 weeks ago, I was in the middle of a sermon.
This is audience participation, so I can't anticipate what questions you might have about the geology locally or geology in general. So if you have questions, don't feel timid at all. You can work those right out, because in a group this size, if you have a question, somebody else probably has that same question and he's too shy to ask. Well,
yeah.
Not him, maybe him. And so that's really the way we'll run this, is in a very casual way and with audience participation. And but a geologist, like most scientists, develop a language that allows me to talk to other geologists in a very precise way so that we know exactly what we're talking about. The problem with that is it closes those conversations to everybody except the cognoscente. So what we're going to talk about for just a few minutes is some basics of the language. And really there are, we'll start with, I don't know, people come with different backgrounds in geology, but we divide the rocks on the earth into three categories. Igneous, okay, we said that everybody who came in late had to pay $5. So, igneous, and those are ones that were at one time a liquid. Now we fudge a little bit, we say kind of near liquid sometimes. But those are all rocks that have been generated, the liquid's been generated down in the crust, sometimes below the crust in the mantle. And so those are granites for the... We call them intrusive rocks, rocks that solidify down in the crust, or lava flows. Lava is a general term or genetic term for lava igneous rocks that have come out on the surface. Now there's a way to tell the difference, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. It's my teaser for you to sit around for another 5 minutes. And when those are out on the surface, exposed to the surface like they are here, they start to erode. The rain does it. Pretty soon there'll be freeze-thaw. That's a really effective agent. But rivers are all very effective agents of erosion. And so those pieces that get eroded get transported down the railroad creek and deposited in the lake. When we got to Lucerne, there was a little round area right there. And maybe I'll get to that and show you that today. But that's where the sediment's going. And so that sediment makes, this is not very creative, but it's sedimentary rocks. Those are sandstones, usually. If they have big clasts, sometimes they're called conglomerates. In the case of chemical precipitates, limestones and rocks that form in the ocean in general. And then if those sedimentary rocks or igneous rocks are buried deeply enough back into the crust, more rocks come in and buried deeply enough, they change. And what happens is the minerals that are stable at the surface, pressure and temperature, are not stable in the crust. So the minerals change, and they change in the solid state. Just, there are some minerals like quartz here, I'm going to show you, that that can't change. Quartz is quartz is quartz. It doesn't matter. But many of the other minerals that make up the rocks are not stable. And so they metamorphose or change in the solid state. No liquid involved here, except maybe water or some other foods. But they change to minerals that are more stable under those temperature and pressure. Does that mean something is happening? No. Okay. So those are the three basic kinds of rocks. The other thing that we're going to talk about are structures, because I'm basically a structural geologist. If they are convex upward, the geologic term is anticline. And if they're convex downward, it's a syncline. And we'll come to that because the rocks right out here are tilted at a high angle. You can see the layers in the mountain here next to us. And those are part of a large fold. I don't know that the rest of the fold is here yet, I can't tell. But those are part of a large fold that I've seen. As you might guess, sometimes anticlines are right next to synclines. And then finally, the last bit of language we need to know about are what geologists refer to as faults. Now, these are not my faults, but faults are fractures in the rock along which there's been some movement. And it was raining, so I didn't go back up and get it, but tomorrow I'll bring down a specimen of faults that I saw. Actually, all these rocks came from the neighborhood right here. While I'm talking about that, if you see me anywhere in the area at Holden, and you think of a question, not in the middle of the night, but you know, walking to breakfast or something, don't hesitate to stop me and we'll talk about that question. I'd be glad to answer those questions. The other thing is, if you go around, now the gardeners are going to be mad at me, because if you go around, that's what I did, I just walked along and looked at the edging on the flower beds, picked up rocks as I went along, and here you are. Now tomorrow, the gardener's going out there and say, hey, what happened? Because some of the rocks are missing from that edge. But what we do is we make observations, and then based on our training and our experience, we make interpretations from those for these rocks. And we're going to make some interpretations before we leave here tonight. But we're going to read the history of the Earth like a book. We should think about this as a book. The time frame for that book is 4.5 billion years old, and tomorrow we're going to talk about deep time. But tonight we're not going to quite get there, I don't think. So we're going to interpret the pages of the book that are here in Holden. And based on that and what other people have observed elsewhere in Washington and the local area, we can start putting together the story. Now most of the book isn't here. 4.5 billion years old, only about a fifth of the book is present in most places, and even in the longest record. And quite often there are things called unconformities, which are gaps in the rock record, where no rocks are represented in that area. So it's like Macbeth. You know, there was a prince from some Scandinavian country, and you know that there was some like murders or something. That's it. That's all we know from here. So to flesh out the rest of that story, we have to go somewhere where the other pages are. Nowhere are all the pages present, so we go and we look all over the area to try and piece that together. And the story that I'm going to tell you about Holden and this area around here in western Washington is based on just that kind of work. Observations, very careful, precise observations made by geologists for a number of years, 100 here, about the rocks and how they fit together in their local area, their pages of that story. And those have been put together. Now the book is still going on. We're still putting the book together because we're still acquiring data. Some of it now is chemical data for rocks that we already knew to try and get more details in the book. So for instance, okay, here's the audience participation. Everybody pick up here now. This is a rock that I picked up on the way over here. And what can we tell about it? I mean, from the back of the room, you guys can see this, right? What is the color?
Gray.
Well, if you look at that close more closely, it is black and white, right? Okay, so that's the first order observation. We walk up and say, well, that's a black and white speckle, but if I throw it up in the air, I'm not going to do that because I might not catch it. I'm going to be in trouble. But that's a first order observation. And now, since we haven't done this, but if you were a geology student, you'd be expected to know what the minerals are in here. Now, a mineral is, I can give you the definition and you don't have to worry about it, but an inorganic, homogeneous substance, so inorganic and homogeneous, with a definite chemical composition and a definite crystal structure. Okay, so mica, you've seen mica in some, well, we might see mica in some of these rocks, quartz, and the black rock, or the black minerals, which pass this around, I don't need to hold it, you guys can look for yourself, you don't have to take my word.
You call this quartz?
The white mineral is probably quartz. The black mineral is probably amphibole, which is a family of minerals, but quartz can't take any iron in it. It's silica and oxygen. Occasionally you get a little something in there to make like amethyst or smoky quartz or something like that. You might see in rock shot. But basically it's silica and oxygen. Silica is the most abundant element in the crust, so you might guess that quartz is pretty abundant, and it is. Amphiboles are another kind of mineral, inorganic, homogeneous, all that, chemical composition, definite crystal structure that's different than quartz. That's where the iron goes. If there's iron in that rock when it melts, it goes, as it cools, it goes into the amphibole. So we've made some observations there. We have a rock that's black and white. The white is probably quartz, maybe some feldspar, which is another mineral, which takes in the aluminum, okay? So you see how that works. Different chemical compositions, they can't all fit in the same crystal structure. So you get different mineral shapes or different crystal forms based on the chemical composition of the rocks. Sorry, minerals. Okay. So what else? What's the size of the grains in there? The back row group back there, you know, in every class there's a back row group, always. Well, they gave the rock up. They passed that rock up pretty fast. It was like a hot potato going on. What's the grain size? Well, it's a, you know, maybe a quarter of an inch. It's hard for me to say inches because everybody I talk to usually is in centimeters. Millimeters and stuff, but it's a, you know, a little pencil lead or a little bigger than a pencil eraser, maybe that size. So we would know that that rock was it's an igneous rock, and because it's coarse grained, that counts as being coarse grained, big grains in it. It crystallized somewhere at depth in the crust of the earth. It didn't come out on the surface. And why? Well, that rock is really hot, 500 or 600 degrees, and it comes out on the surface and it's essentially zero. And so it quenches really fast, and the crystals don't have time to grow, the minerals don't have time to grow. So that rock we know cooled in the crust of the earth somewhere. How far? I don't know yet. There are ways to tell, but we wouldn't be able to tell just by looking at that specimen. And those igneous rocks with lots of quartz in them that crystallize deep in the crust are generally referred to as granites. That one's not a granite. Granite to a geologist has a very specific definition, and it has a potassium feldspar in it, a feldspar that takes in the potassium. Now that's not a trivial matter, because potassium is a huge ion, huge molecule. And so the crystal structure that will accept potassium needs to be a certain ion, and feldspars, potassium feldspars, are one of those. Well, that doesn't have much potassium in it, and so that's technically, to a geeky geologist, not a granite. Although we call them granites or granitic rocks, is actually the way we get around not knowing what exactly that is. I think that's a quartz diorite or a granite diorite, but that's okay. So that's one of the rocks from right around here. And you'll go around, and if you look at the flower beds on your way back, and you'll be in a hurry because you'll be raining, you'll see lots of granitic rocks around here, lots of this quartz diorite. The other rock that's quite common is these schists. And these were at one time sedimentary rocks and were pushed down by loading or structure into the middle of the crust. And they have been metamorphosed to different mineral assemblages. As a matter of fact, all the sort of remnants of these being sedimentary rocks, like bed forms formed in streams and stuff like that, all gone. By the time you get to this level of metamorphism, there's nothing left from the original. Fossils, gone. You don't have any fossils in them. But you can see a few things. Let's see, I picked on you first. Did I pick on you before?
Okay, I'll pick on you. You get $5 to get in.
If you, oh, that's right, yeah. Good going, man.
Hey, I got to pay you back.
One
somehow.
Of the things you see from these rocks, these metamorphic rocks, and these guys didn't get to see them, so when it comes around, is that they are banded. They have layers in them. And those layers are formed by shear. So when these rocks get to the middle crust, they're hot. And the minerals get ductile. They don't melt, but they're pretty ductile. Sort of like clay or something. And they, when they get sheared by flowage, by faults or whatever, they get that layering in them. And you'll see that as it goes around. Those are the second big type of rocks that are here, metasedimentary rocks. Now, here in the Holden area, they have actually dated the minerals. You say, well, I dated a couple of rock kids, but I never dated a mineral. Well, you can do that based on radioactive decay, because there are radioactive isotopes in those minerals. And if we know how fast they decay, and we know the decay constant, and we know how many daughter products there are, we can back calculate to find out how many parent isotopes there were. So there are lots of isotopes in nature. One of the big ones, of course, is uranium. Goes through several steps, but finally gets to lead. So if we know the decay constant of uranium and all the daughters, the intermediate daughters, and we know how much lead is in the rock, we just back calculate and figure out how old that rock is. Now, there's a little bit of slop in that, so what do? We date a whole bunch of those minerals. We sort of get a statistical number. And it's amazing to me how precise those chemical measurements are. The labs are really good. And we use lots of different kinds of minerals. We don't just take uranium to lead, sometimes it's potassium to argon, a variety of things. So we'll take the same rock and we'll date lots of different minerals in that rock to try and figure out how old it is. The protolith, or the parent rock for that, for these metamorphic rocks that are going around, are about 250 million years old. So they were deposited on a seafloor 250 million years ago. Now tomorrow we're going to get into deep time. It's always a question whether you should talk about time or rocks first, because time turns out to be the principal the principal contribution that geology makes to the rest of science, is understanding how long it is. 250 million years, we talked about a geologist cavalier.
300 million, yeah,
no problem. It's a big number. Here's another one that came from the flower bed. And this is a quartz vein, and is mentioned in the early reports about the mineralization here, the mining minerals. And so when these rocks melt, when the protoliths melt, if you take these rocks, take them down into the middle crust, they start to melt, but the minerals melt individually. They each have their own melting temperature. Quartz is the lowest, and then feldspar, and then you get up to some more refractory minerals. So the first thing to come off as you start to heat it up at about 500 or 600 degrees C is quartz. It melts. The other thing that's in there, although not big, it's not like you couldn't wring this rock out and get the water out of it. There is water in these rocks. And today there's a lot more water than that. But chemically, there is water bound in these rocks. And so as these rocks get pressed, water is incompressible. And it doesn't form into the crystals. It's in between the minerals. And so it would like to leave. The higher the pressure, the more it would like to leave. And when quartz melts, now it's a liquid, and it also is incompressible. And it would like to leave due to lower pressure. Fluids go from high pressure to low pressure. You have a hydroelectric plant here. It's easy enough to know you got a head there to bring that water through the plant. Well, gold, it turns out, is a fugitive ion. It's big and it's noble. You know, that's why you can have wedding rings and they don't tarnish. It's because it doesn't oxidize. It doesn't form complexes with other chemicals. So it is not bound in the minerals. And so when the water and the quartz crack through the rock and leave under high pressure, the gold goes with it. Because it's a fugitive, it would like to get out of the system. That's why lots of places, including here, you find the gold with the quartz veins. Because it's carrying the gold because it wants to leave. Just because it's chemically inert. Okay, question here. Yeah.
So that is quartz?
I think that's quartz, yeah. Okay. So how would we tell? What observations could we tell? Well, what we have done, what geologists have done, is they've devised a scale of hardness of minerals. And quartz is, to the geeky geologist, 7. Talc is 1, and calcite, limestone is 3. So what we need to do, it turns out that stainless steel or a knife blade is 5. So if we scratch that quartz, if we put this knife blade and scratch it across the quartz, is the quartz going to scrape or is the knife blade going to scrape? This is 5, that's 7. Make a prediction.
That's going to scrape.
This is going to scrape, yeah, off that. Yeah. Okay, let's run the experiment. Whoop.
But if you put that in an oven at 700 degrees, would it melt?
Yeah.
In
okay.
Celsius.
Celsius, yeah.
Pretty hot.
You are so right.
How hot is our knife?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See how easy this is? I can't believe I get paid. Okay, so the quartz veins here are coming from the earliest phases of the melting that then probably produced this. They melted the iron and magnesium minerals. And then as it sat there in the middle of the crust for a while, it solidified. And it had enough time to make crystals this big. If you've ever been to the Sierra Nevada, you know that the crystals get this big because they have a long time. Earth is a good insulator, and so it just holds that heat in there, and the crystals just keep growing and growing and growing until they get cooled off. Okay, so now we can make some other observations. This one's fun because this one is a little darker than the granitic rock that I picked up, but it is basically the same. It just has more of the iron magnesium minerals in it. But if you look at the side, you notice it's stretched. It has stripes on this side where the grains have actually been stretched out. So this is a igneous rock that has been sheared. It's been sheared so that the minerals have been all stretched out. So maybe there was faulting going on while this rock was solidifying that caused it to shear and those minerals to shear off and form that. But you can see the stripes as you go along. Now, there are a few geologic principles that have been developed since the 16 and 1700s.
Ben, you've been upstage.
Yeah. That's somebody after my remarks. She's trying to talk her out of that apple. That's something hard to do. Okay, there are some principles that are really simple logic, but are important to interpreting what we see in the rock record. The first is superposition. That sounds worse than it is. But if we have a layer of rocks, and I'm just going to label those 1, 2, 3, what we know now is that this one had to be there before the next one could be deposited, and the next one. And you say, ah.
Yeah.
And that's right. But in the early days, see, I'm going to hang around over here now. In the early days, when the church said that all of the rocks were deposited in the Great Flood, they were all the same age. And how could you tell? And so it was a big change during the Renaissance, during the Age of Reason, that they figured out that this one must be older. Whoop. Dad's going to get that one.
Less than 10 seconds.
How much older? Well, we didn't actually know at that time. There was an understanding that the fossils got more complex higher in the section. So you go from simpler forms to more complex forms. So that's one of the principles that we needed to understand. The second was, if you have a fault here in, say, bed 3, bed 2, bed 1, are offset along that fault. So this is a cross-section. It's like we looking sideways into the earth. These rocks had to be there in order to be cut by that fault. And you go, well, of course. Well, now that seems simple. But that was a major sort of breakthrough understanding this law of cross-cutting relationships, we call that. So that things that cross-cut other things, the rocks had to be there before they could be cut by the fault. That's it. That's as complicated. Well, it's not quite as complicated as the logic gets, but for most of what we do, we are dealing with what's up, what's the oldest, what's the youngest, and the cross-cutting relationships. And we can do that here. Okay, you say? Everyone nodded. Let's see here. Okay, so we can make some more observations on this one. These are the gneisses and schists. You can actually see the banding in there, maybe from the back of the room, I don't know, from the period can. And you can see this more amorphous zone has cut away, as is here in this part. And that's exactly what happened. The gneisses and schists of the metamorphic terrain that's right up the hill have been cut by the granitic rocks. So right now, that one the kids probably won't handle because right now we can just observe, and we know the relative ages of the metamorphic rocks and the igneous rocks. And so we've already started figuring out the geologic history of the Holden area. Yeah, that's a heavy guy.
That's a heavy.
Okay. Well, you guys are looking at that. You have your own specimens over here. Here are the metamorphic rocks, although they're pretty finely crystalline here. This might actually be a little bit of an igneous rock, but it's cut by this vein right there. And that vein is quartz, and there are some amphiboles in there. I don't know what all those are. This guy's here. And you'll notice in that one that he's got there, the contact between the metamorphic rocks and the igneous rock, it has a little white band right along the edge. And what was happening there was that as the igneous rock, as the granitic rock was being intruded, you want me to throw one up there? You guys want?
It's all right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Probably just as well. We're getting to the heavy ones now. As that one was, as the... it's back there now. But as that was being intruded, there was a chemical reaction between the metamorphic rocks and the igneous rocks. And iron magnesium minerals, the dark minerals, were sort of preferentially leached out of that. And so what's left is this little white band right next to it. Okay. Questions? Remember I said you could wear them out. Don't save them.
Okay, I got a quick question.
Yeah.
How can you tell the difference in the metamorphic rocks between ones that were initially igneous and initially sedimentary?
At this grade of metamorphism, these are fairly middle grade metamorphisms, and we grade metamorphism by the mineral assemblage, right?
Yes.
Because we said that the low temperature, low pressure minerals change down in the crust of the earth to ones that are more stable. And then those get buried more deeply, and they change again, and change again, and change again. So we look at the mineral assemblage in here, and these have a lot of amphibole in them. So we know that they're middle crust. There is a whole grade of metamorphic rocks called amphibolite grade. So we look at the mineral assemblage. By the time these guys get to this state, these metamorphic rocks that are going around, there is no vestige of the protolith. It's gone.
Okay.
It's been crystallized and stretched and strained so highly that the fossils are all stretched out and gone. You can't identify any of that. So we can do that by the mineral assemblage and then back calculating back to the but, you know, there's some places where it's not clear. You know, if you have a lot of mafic minerals, iron or magnesium minerals, magnesium and iron, chemical symbol for iron is Fe, so we call those mafic minerals. But if you have a lot of those iron and magnesium minerals in it, it probably didn't start out as a sedimentary. Because lots of times the earth is really efficient at winnowing out those. They're not stable at the earth's surface, really. They're what we call metastable. So they break down, but much more quickly than the quartz. Okay. So let me do one more thing. Go to my multimedia. And I want to show you this is a series of diagrams. So what I said, what we were interested in was Earth's history. And so I'm going to jump from Holden, and I'm going to jump to what is now North America, although at the time you wouldn't have noticed that. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the growth of the geologic timescale, and to jump ahead a little bit, give you a little bit of advance warning, we have named periods of time names for right now. So this is Cambrian, but those names then mean a period of time. They're just, we could call them anything, but it's a time, and it was all based on fossils. So this is 510 million years ago. There are some small critters. There are lingula. Gastropods that sort of look like a little clamshell, they look exactly the same today. They have survived. What wouldn't survive now are things like trilobites. Trilobites look like a pill bug, kind of. They're marine. Sometimes they got really big. You've probably seen pictures or seen them in rock shops. The Burgess Shale would be just right up here, which is a famous locality for Cambrian fossils. It's one of several now around the world. We found some others. But it was the rocks or the fossils were the subject of Stephen Gould's book, Wonderful Life. I don't know if you've read that. Wonderful Life, these Burgess Shale from about this time. The Burgess Shale is the name of a formation. We also give our formations names based on where they were first studied. And the Burgess Shale from right up here in Canada was found, the fossils were found originally by a guy named Walcott in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And it's a World Heritage Site. Now we know there's some more of it. But it had such a rich fauna, including trilobites and things. But it had some things that Walcott never knew, couldn't imagine what they were. In his Victorian sort of background, at that time most of the geologists were gentlemen geologists. He worked for the U.S. Geological Survey and a university. He just couldn't imagine that there were any phyla on Earth in the past that were not represented today. So he stuffed all those life forms represented by the fossils, into the phyla that we know today, crustaceans, and so on. Well, in the 80s, a man named Simon Conway Morris went back and looked at the Burgess Shale, the Walcott fossils, and he reinterpreted them completely. And it was a real eye-opener, because some of the fossils that Walcott collected actually do exist. They were represented early examples of phyla, crustaceans. But there were some others that didn't fit in anything. They were not easily fit into any existing phyla. And so that's actually what he said. And the name for this now, and sometimes you'll see that, is the Cambrian Explosion. And it's about life on Earth experimenting. So there weren't any rules, of course. So there were critters that grew and developed and evolved didn't get passed through the next extinction event. And so what Stephen Gould did was he said, okay, evolution is almost a crapshoot. If you're at the right place at the right time, you pass through. And if you're at the wrong place, like the dinosaurs were when the bolide hit, then it's curtains. And So his premise was, Stephen Gould's premise was, that if you played the tape recorder of life on Earth forward again from the beginning, from the Cambrian explosion, you would not get where we are today. That it's there's too much chance involved in where you are and what niche you're in at the time that the climate changes. That's something we need to think about. Or, well, we don't, we'll pass through with maybe with some artery. You know, if you can't accept higher salinities in the ocean, and all of a sudden it gets saline, you're gone. And the guy that can't accept higher salinities passes through and evolves. And so that was Stephen Gould's premise. That if you played the tape recorder forward, and I'd encourage you to read Stephen Gould's book, Wonderful Life, and it's named after the Capra movie, the hokey Capra movie that you see like 130 times at Christmas. You know? Everybody's seen that. Some people actually own the DVD. What would happen if you weren't born? You know, and so that's where he got the title. Simon Conway Morris, this is just an aside now, Simon Conway Morris was so mad about that that he wrote his own book called Crucible of Creation that says no. That the niches are there to be populated in evolutionary space. And if you played the tape recorder, probably those niches would be filled just like they are until you get to us, or the deer out here in the quad. And so there's a big debate about that. Unfortunately for Conway Morse, Stephen Gould was an excellent writer. I don't know if you're familiar with him from the natural history columns and his books, various other books. But he's just an excellent writer. Conway Morris's book was unreadable, and so people are gonna remember Gould's hypothesis, but it is a hypothesis. It's not proven. People are still. Anyway, that's the Cambrian explosion that happened right there. Now there's some sites in China. They made this a World Heritage Site. You can only go up there, if you go to Field, BC, British Columbia, you can only go up there with a ranger now. It's a quarry about a little bigger than this room, not much bigger. And it's got like thousands, tens of thousands of these delicately preserved fossils. So a lot of them are like nothing else on Earth. Ever. And it didn't pass through. Okay, so that was an aside for this whole thing. Where was I going with this? Well, where I was going was that using lots of observations like we have come up with a Earth history. These are a series of images made by a friend of mine and my staff, a guy named Ron Pinky, and they are like satellite images from the past. Everybody's seen satellite images, you know, on Google Earth at CNN, you know. And well, what Blakey did was put the geology together and make it like a satellite image, although this is all in North America, and you can see the state and province boundaries on there, from the past. And so what I'd like to do is go through this in time. Now, I've set these up. Unfortunately, they're a little bit herky-jerky because I didn't have the time to make them all over. Put them all in the right position so it goes smoothly. And people are so used to good post-production that any herky-jerky stuff looks like, whoa, man, this guy's really an amateur. Well, it's harder than you think, but if you look at Saskatchewan, that's the province of Saskatchewan right there, if you kind of keep that as a reference point, okay, you'll be able to look at these as you go along. What do we notice about Washington in the Cambrian?
Doesn't exist.
It ain't there. There is nothing on North America in the location of Washington. Where there used to be a piece out here, and it rifted away, it got faulted away, and It's now in eastern Siberia. I have a friend, a classmate of mine from Flagstaff that's working on that. But never mind that. Let's watch what happens to Washington as we go through time. And these maps are based on every geologist's observation. We write it in papers, we put it in journals, scientific journals, and that's how we get these pictures. So this is the book, sort of, on a grand scale of North America. Okay, so you see Greenland was part of North America, but Washington isn't even a gleam in our eye. So here's the Ordovician. Now the dates are down here. These are in millions of years, so 480 million years. Again, tomorrow we'll talk about, if I'm in your way, you can push me out of the way. So this is Ordovician. The landmass changes. This is shallow water. This is a little deeper water, and then this is abyssal. This is ocean terrain. So what you're going to see is the oceans come. It's just a few hundred meters deep. The seas go in and the seas go out, but we can talk about that maybe as we go along this week, because it's important. Here are some pieces that are coming in. That's part of the early part of the Appalachians. It's actually it's different. It's called the Taconic, but never mind. Now, the Appalachians are formed. A Taconic is formed. It's shedding all that sediment down into New York and Pennsylvania, called the Mock Chunk and some of those. But still no Washington. But look at here. Here's some stuff coming in, right? It's coming across the ocean. I was just thinking, everybody watches. Today they watch the Discovery Channel and all that, most people are tuned into this. But what we found, I won't go any further with this for right now, what we found after World War II was they put out seismometers around the world. And what they were looking for was the Russians blowing up the atomic tests. And they didn't find very many of those guys. They couldn't afford very many atomic bombs, I guess. But what they found was, on the surface of the globe, earthquakes, and this was really a surprise, earthquakes sort of lined up along zones on the Earth's crust. And when that data then was made available to geophysicists and geologists, we realized that the Earth's surface is made up of tectonic plates. And those plates move relative to one another as they rotate on the sphere on the Earth's surface. And so if these things are moving apart, if you think about what's happening just right over here, say, if crust is being created there, like it is in the middle of the Atlantic. I don't have a good picture of that, maybe till later. If created there, then unless you're going to make the Earth bigger, which was a hypothesis early on, that the Earth was actually expanding, it is a zero-sum game. That means somewhere the crust has to be destroyed. Now, what do we know about continental crust? That's got a lot of quartz in it. They said it's the most abundant element. Silica is, and quartz is one of the most abundant minerals on Earth. And it's light compared to the stuff that's got iron and magnesium in it. So it turns out that the continental crust are light, and the oceanic crusts are heavy. So when they come together, like right here, this will be oceanic crust here and here, and this will be continental crust. When they meet right there, something's got to give, or else the Earth has to get bigger. They say that was a hypothesis that was argued for a while. And what happens is a process we call subduction. And so the continental crust is light and buoyant. The oceanic crust is more dense, and so it heads down in what we call a subduction zone. So it disappears back into the mantle. And so if pieces are here, like say an island arc like Japan, and it's riding on this oceanic crust, as that starts to be destroyed, what's going to happen? It gets closer and closer and closer and closer and closer, and finally runs into North America. And that's a preface for that's a preface for what we're going to talk about when we talk about flotsam and jetsam, I think I called it. Because it turns out that most of Washington, all of Alaska, you see Alaska's not on there either, is all made up of flotsam and jetsam that came from somewhere else. And this is the first sort of inkling. If we had gone on vacation here on the beach in the Silurian 430 million years ago, we could have looked off there and seen an arc. This is probably an island arc like Japan or Indonesia, coming closer and closer and closer.
So is there more land above water now than back then?
The amount of land, the amount of freeboard on the earth changes. And it changes, well, the freeboard doesn't change, the amount of water, sort of container, the ocean basin changes shape through time, so that pushes more water out onto the continent.
So does the ocean become deeper? I mean, I know we can only just
No, it actually becomes shallower here because you're pushing it up into, what's that, Montana and Saskatchewan, right? So this is low enough, it's like North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And if you raise sea level 300 meters, it's underwater. Mm-hmm. We're going to see that as we go along here. What's happening is that probably the amount of water is about the same, mm-hmm. but the ocean basins are changing shape. And so when they're shallow or when they have more volume pushing that up, the water spreads out. What's going to happen? The other thing that does that is what? Glaciers, right? That's a big concern now for global warming because the ice in Greenland and the ice in Antarctica is going away. Where's it going? Into the ocean. And people have, you know, depending on who you talk to, 30 meters or 50 meters or 100 meters. What we know is that during the Ice Age, we'll get to that in a minute, during the Ice Age, the ocean was about 300 meters lower. So that's what some people have suggested. The myth of the Great Flood, which is in lots of different cultures, came from the Black Sea when the ice started melting and the ocean started filling in the Mediterranean. Started filling in the Black Sea, and it came really fast, and so these guys had to move up shore faster. That's intriguing, but it's kind of hard to prove. Okay. So nothing from Washington yet. We're going to hear. Devonian 400 million years. That thing's getting closer, isn't it? It's coming onshore. It actually comes onshore. Some remnants of that are found in Canada and up here in the Arctic of Canada, and then some places in the Sierra Nevada. We see remnants of this collision in the Devonian and in the Mississippian that caused uplifts here as this piece of oceanic terrain came onshore. That's exactly what's happened in Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea is a piece of Australia that's being forced back up on Australia. And so, this, let's get up into something we can recognize here.
It used to be a piece of Australia and now it's coming back.
Yeah. It's a piece of the continental shelf of Australia that's now being forced back up on Australia. So the highlands in Papua New Guinea are structures related to that shortening as it goes back up on Australia. Okay, so more flotsam and jetsam coming on board. Still nothing in Washington. Maybe. Not where we can see it very well. Certainly not here. So, by this time now, this is when those rocks that were the protolith for those metamorphic rocks were being deposited. They were being deposited in oceanic basins that stood probably just offshore of the Northwest. These are probably related to North America. That's different than Western Washington, which didn't have anything to do with North America until fairly recently.
Question.
You can see that the...
Is that Africa that's forming there off to the right?
Yes, that's South America and that's Africa, that's right. This is the collision to form a supercontinent that we call Pangaea. These are the Appalachians. Well, let's see. Appalachians. Yeah, good eye. The other thing is from this, I thought I had it here. There. The continents are rotating as they're rotating down the sphere. So north doesn't always mean north, you know. This time, north was off in that direction as North America rotated during its motion. Okay, by the Triassic now, the Appalachians are starting to split apart. South America and Africa are leaving. They came together, but they don't last very long, these big supercontinents, because they hold the heat in. And so that heat then is the engine that drives them away. We're getting there. Triassic, that's when some of these rocks were also deposited. The Jurassic, from Jurassic Park. Only a couple of dinosaurs in the whole movie were Jurassic in age. T-Rex, was it? So this is the flotsam and jetsam that makes up a good portion of Washington. It's oceanic and some continental fragments that were accreted, we call them, but smushed onto North America by the motion of those oceanic plates that are just taking those continental fragments that can't be subducted, they can't sink, and just smooshing them onto the
Is that based on fossils, some of this?
Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, there's a terrain here. We call these fault-bounded plates, little plates, terrains, actually green plates too. And there is one here stuck between two continental plates. It's oceanic in its nature, and it has Asian fossils in it. So we go, whoa, that came a long way. Well, yes, it did. This sort of opened our eyes to how mobile the Earth really is. We've got just a couple minutes here. I'm trying to get to the meat of the cooking up here. Here's Washington, still pieces, flotsam and jetsam. It's just debris all the way to the Idaho border. It's probably debris. So by the late Cretaceous, 100 million years ago, now that stuff has started to attach itself in North America. Some of it attached out here somewhere and then came in as a group. Yeah.
Is it, were the Cascades formed by most of that debris hitting each other?
No, the Cascades are new.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
So they came later.
Yeah, much later. The Cascades are erupted, the volcanoes of the Cascades are erupted and sit on top of this stuff. Mm-hmm.
And why does that body of water, you know, extend through that whole place?
Here.
Yeah.
Well, it's low topography, and it's a relative high stand. This is called the Great Interior Seaway in Western North America, and is a couple thousand feet thick, the sediment. But it was just low topography and high stand of the seas, and they just flooded the lowest portion of the continent, which happened to be right along here. We can get into why that was, isn't it? Okay. Late Cretaceous. Here is the end of the Cretaceous. And most everyone has heard about the end of the Cretaceous. Because right down here in Yucatan is where a bull-eyed, and I really exaggerate, because it was like 5 or 10 kilometers across. But when it hit and went into the ocean only covered it halfway. Well, it only covered it halfway for a microsecond, because then it exploded. But that's where the that's where we think the meteorite hit that caused the nuclear winter. There are a variety of hypotheses about why the dinosaurs went extinct, but this is it. That time was it. Now, whether there's volcanoes other places. Okay. Paleocene. Eocene, there some of these granitic rocks are intruded. These are Eocene in age, some of them. So this is the time when there were probably large volcanoes. We don't all actually know that because not much of that debris is left. But we certainly see the roots of the volcano that were solidified at great depth. Okay, here we go. We're getting close now. There is when the Cascades formed. Now, one last thing and then I'll let you go. What happens when oceanic crust gets subducted is it has water in it. And so the metamorphic reactions that happen to this oceanic crust has lots of iron and magnesium in it, but it also has water. So when those minerals start to metamorphose, and it's essentially a dehydration reaction. So the water comes off of this subducted slab, we call it the oceanic crust. And there are a couple ways to make rocks melt. You can lower the pressure and they melt. You can increase the heat and they melt, or you can add water. All rocks melt at lower temperatures if they have water. So these rocks melt, they come to the surface. That's the Cascades. That's what's happening today in the Cascades. It's going on right now, Mount St. Helens. But we'll come back to the Cascades later on in the week. Pliocene, only 3 million years before present. Pleistocene, great ice surges across here. I said the sea level was down about 300 meters, so there was big, broad shells. People lived out on those shells, and then when the sea level came back up, they had to scoot out of the way. A mile of ice. Sometimes 2 miles of ice in railroad canyon. Probably only about a kilometer, so half a mile of ice. Now, when glaciers come together, the little glacier meets the big valley glacier and sort of meets it and goes along with it. You've seen pictures of Alaska where that's happening. What happens when the glacier recedes is this valley no longer is cut down. It was cheating. It wasn't coming in at the bottom. It was coming in at the top. The ice was coming in at the top. When the glacier recedes, what happens? Well, that valley gets left behind. The main valley is down here, and the side valley is way up here. That's why you have to do all the switchbacks when you come up from Lucerne. You're coming up into what is a hanging valley, we call it, because the ice that was in here was not as much ice as was out there in the lake, the valley, but it has all the characteristics. U-shape, well, we'll come back to that when we talk about glaciers. Okay, to today, and there we are. So these maps have been constructed, the geologic history constructed based on the observations just like you made today. Quartz, amphibole, the quartz vein, the shearing, That's the kind of observations geologists make when they're out in the field. And then we put it together for our little area. Here you are right there. Oh yeah, there we are. But, and then the, everybody does that for their own area, and we piece those together for a particular time. Well, present's not hard, because we can't start to go there, but for the past. Tomorrow, what did I say I was going to talk about tomorrow?
Deep time.
And deep time is the, I say, the most important contribution that geologists have made to science in general. They've made other contributions, but they're understanding how much time there is. So tomorrow we're going to talk about how that idea evolved and how the geologic time scale, and I have time scales for everyone. When you come tomorrow, you will get a time scale. Today I told you one. But if you come tomorrow, we'll get a time scale, we'll talk about this. And talk about Cambrian and Ordovician and Mississippian and all those names and how they developed and what they mean. Okay?